It is Friday, November the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, struggles in Iraq facing the besieged people of Mosul.
A whole lot of problems facing them. I mean, we've had a couple of, instances of accidental bombings by coalition forces killing civilians.
More migrants die on the high seas. The U.S. race to see who'll be the next president. Plus country music awards and lots of social media news. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. An audio recording of a man claiming to be Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, leader of the Islamic State, has emerged, encouraging his followers to fight for the Iraqi city of Mosul.
إن هذه المعركة المستعرة والحرب الشاملة والجهاد الكبير
said, this total war and the great jihad that Islamic State is fighting only increases our firm belief, he said, God willing, and our conviction that all of this is a prelude to victory. The authenticity of the audio claim cannot be independently verified. The release of the audio comes 2 weeks after Iraqi-led forces launched an assault to recapture the city, 2 years after it was overrun by IS militants. After capturing several surrounding towns, elite Iraqi troops are said to be consolidating gains made this week after entering the city limits from the east. They're preparing to enter the more urban central neighborhoods where house-to-house combat could take weeks or even months. Regional analyst Anthony Billingsley, a senior lecturer in Middle East politics and international law at the University of New South Wales, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the message is an attempt to rally Islamic State fighters who appear virtually cut off and facing a superior force.
I think he probably has to come up with something. As you say, he's been very quiet. We've had this growing impending defeat with people fleeing Mosul. We had Dabiq, the town in the west of Syria, which was, of course, of great theological significance to Islamic State, which was sort of handed over almost without a fight. So I think there's a need for al-Baghdadi to start to remind his followers that they have this massive battle ahead of them. Otherwise, I think he's going to have great trouble holding the numbers together.
Do you anticipate he's still in Mosul, or do you think he's fled?
I know that a lot of people did flee. He's been so secretive that we basically haven't had much of an idea where he is. I'm sure if the U.S. knew where he was, he'd be he'd have been dealt with by now.
There are scenes of people fleeing neighborhoods of Mosul, men with long beards and, of course, women in full-dress niqabs. Obviously, they have been living under a state of strict Islamic law for the past 2 years. How difficult will it be for them to acclimate to normal life again?
At one level, I suspect that it'll be easy for them to trim their beards and get rid of the face covering, that sort of thing. But there's a whole lot of problems facing them. I mean, we've had a couple of, instances of accidental bombings by coalition forces killing civilians. We've had reports from Amnesty that people who are suspected of some sort of sympathy or complicity with Islamic State being mistreated by Iraqi forces, either militia or the regular army. So there's going to be a lot of political tension as these people do try to acclimatize. Plus, of course, for the time being, and we've got people saying that this is going to take months to complete the clearing of fighters and booby traps and all the rest in Mosul itself, that they're going to be stacked away in some sort of refugee camps. And by the sound of things, that is not anywhere near ready yet.
More than 20,000 civilians have already fled the government-held area since the offensive began on October 17. The Norwegian Refugee Council said the lives of 1.2 million civilians are in grave danger there, and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says throughout Iraq, some 10 million people are in need of aid. Among the other stories we're following on VOA, Afghan fighting kills 30 its civilians and two U.S. soldiers are among others. Nairobi anti-corruption protest turns violent, and South Korea's political theater geopolitical implications continue. Expanding coverage of those stories more at voanews.com and, as always, on our VOA mobile app. The International Organization for Migration is reporting that at least 240 migrants, mostly from West Africa, have died or disappeared in two shipwrecks off the coast of Libya. IOM says 29 survivors, including women, children, and several babies, were brought to Lampedusa, Italy, by the Italian Coast Guard. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration says most of the migrants already had died by the time rescuers arrived. IOM spokesman Itai Viriri tells VOA about 12 bodies have been fished out of the sea and more are likely to be recovered as the rescue effort continues.
It is a really, really big worry because we are seeing these unprecedented numbers of people dying when normally around this time of year, whilst there have been tragedies like this, we've never really experienced the numbers that we're seeing now. The fact that we are already talking of over 4,200 dead, when the whole of last year we're talking of 3,700, is of huge concern.
Viriri says smugglers are apparently persuading the migrants to make the treacherous journey by telling them Europe is going to turn over the rescue mission to the Libyan and Tunisian coast guards, and now might be their last chance to leave North Africa.
The smugglers are certainly using that as a ploy to make sure that people who normally would not consider getting onto boats at this time of year, when the seas are really, really choppy and rough, that they reconsider, you know, because as the smugglers are telling them, they won't get that opportunity in the near future when, first of all, the Libyan and Tunisian coast guards clamp down on boats being launched off their shores.
Viriri says another big worry is that smugglers are piling the migrants into rubber dinghies. He says these flimsy craft are not suitable for the Mediterranean at any time of year, but they are especially dangerous now in the choppy winter seas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meantime, France has closed the so-called Calais Jungle, a migrant camp in the northern part of the country, relocating the refugees to other camps across France, including one in Paris. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field speaks with my colleague Laurie London about the migrant situation in France.
What we're seeing is several different strategies by the French government. The first one is to close the Calais Jungle. Now, they've succeeded in that. Last week, they moved out about 6,000 of these migrants, and they've moved them into various resettlement centers around the country. And then this week, they moved out 1,600 unaccompanied minors also to 60 centers around the country. Now, that essentially means that the Calais camp has closed. That having been said, the United Nations is still very critical of France. It said that it's just not enough to put these unaccompanied minors onto buses and take them to resettlement camps. They say there need to be better procedures and safeguards, that these people, and particularly the minors, are looked after. They've accused the French government and the British government of passing the buck, that for at least a year these minors have been in that camp. They haven't been looked after. The French have said that the British will take them. The British have said they'll take them if the French get all the paperwork done. The UN has now said, OK, you've moved them out of Calais. You've got to move quicker, and these kids can't just be put into a different camp. What the French are hoping for, particularly the government, is that by the end of this weekend, the major magnets for migrants will be closed down. They won't exist. So you've got Calais that's closed down. They will have moved everyone off the streets of Paris and into resettlement camps. Then, once that's happened, they believe the magnets for these migrants coming to Paris and coming to the Calais camps will have gone, and that they will be able to deal with this situation elsewhere. And then, of course, what will happen is winter will intervene. They're also hoping that fewer people will set out from the coast of Libya on these boats to try and make it through to Europe.
What is the general public feeling about the situation? Is there sort of one particular mind of what has been happening and how this all has been handled? Or is there a sense of compassion or just sort of irritation about the whole thing?
Certainly here in Paris, you get the feeling that there's a lot of compassion. you always go to these camps and you see people giving out food, giving out blankets, giving out tents. But of course, there are the politicians on the extremes of the political spectrum who are making hay out of this. And that's another reason why the French government has moved with this, because you've got the extreme right and the extreme left saying to the French President François Hollande, look, this shows what a useless president you are. You cannot deal with this issue. So on this one, he's looked tough, he's acted tough, and he's finally getting on top of it. That having been said, he's getting on top of it 2 years after it came up. There is a feeling that the European Union has missed the boat on it. They just really have not got on top of this migrant issue. They haven't gotten on top of it either here in Europe when the migrants arrive. They haven't got on top of it in countries where the migrants set out. And that is where, again, you're seeing questions about how effective is Europe, when in fact this has been going on for now several years, and it's been on our television screens, people setting off on rickety boats, often losing their lives on the way, and the European Union just has been unable to come up with some unified, concrete program to get to the bottom of this, to stop people getting on boats and risking their lives.
That is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field speaking with International Edition's Laurie London.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
And turning now to U.S. presidential politics, where the pre-election voter surveys are tightening only days ahead of the November 8th voting. Nominees of the major political parties and their surrogates outflocking the so-called swing states of Florida, North Carolina, and Arizona, trying to convince voters to vote for them. Mariama Diallo has our report.
In this final stretch, both Republican and Democratic nominees are pushing hard, and so are their surrogates. For the first time since the conventions, Melania Trump stumps for a husband she's known for 18 years.
Love for this country is something we immediately shared with when I met Donald. He loves this country, and he knows how to get things done, not just talk. He certainly knows how to shake things up, doesn't he?
In Miami on Thursday, President Obama reminded the crowd they don't have to wait until Election Day to exercise their civic duty.
What does that say up there? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. What does it say up there? You know, I'm still not hearing it. What? Vote early. If you are registered, you can vote right now.
But Republican Party nominee Donald Trump, who's also been campaigning in Florida, says the president shouldn't be there.
This guy ought to get back to the office and stop campaigning.
Voting in the Sunshine State could determine the outcome of the election. Florida is a pivotal state with 29 electoral votes out of the 270 needed to win the presidency.
Real change begins with immediately repealing and replacing Obamacare.
As the Republican candidate vows to repeal one of the president's signature policies, the commander-in-chief says it's all talk.
They want to repeal because ideologically they're opposed to the idea of helping these 20 million people get health insurance. It's not like they don't even have a pretense of a plan. They don't even have a semblance of a plan. There's not even a hint of a plan. Not even a moat. Not even a... There's no plan. Nothing. Zero. Nada.
Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton campaigned Wednesday in Arizona, a state that has voted Republican for the past 68 years, except once.
Arizona has only voted for a Democrat for president once since 1948, and that was my husband in 1996.
Clinton says her campaign has a real chance to once again win the state's 11 Electoral College votes. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And coming up next, our social media expert will be here with what's happening online about the election. Meantime, you can go to our website for all the latest on the U.S. election, voanews.com. This is VOA.
On Tuesday, November 8th, all eyes will be on America as voters choose the next U.S. president. Tune in to our live comprehensive coverage with our correspondents around the country and around the world. Starting Tuesday at 2200 hours UTC GMT and continuing through Wednesday morning right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. It is now time to find out what is trending on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. The World Series wrapped up Wednesday night, and if you're anywhere in North America, it'll be hard for you not to notice that on social media. The annual baseball game was between the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians.
Not all of us know what was so special about this year's event, so why don't you update us on that?
Sure. Not only was it one of the most dramatic and intense games ever, but the Cubs won for the first time in 108 years.
That is indeed a long wait, any way you look at it. What are the people sharing about it on Twitter?
Steve, although it was a great day for the Cubs fans, that was not the case for the Indians fans. In fact, people are having a good laugh about an Indians fan who prematurely got a tattoo that shows his team as this year's champion. The poor lad actually got on the Chicago public transportation system called the L, and a lot of people took notice. One person tweeted, "You can always change the A to a U, right? That'll change the word from champs to chumps." Yikes.
Anything else out there trending?
American action star Steven Seagal, because he's now officially a Russian citizen. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a decree granting citizenship to Seagal. People are tweeting about his relationship with Putin, with one tweet claiming he described the Russian president as one of the greatest world leaders.
I see. And what about on the U.S. election side?
Hashtag IAmWithHer is trending, which is a play on words from Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan, IAmWithHer, and NBC reporter Katie Turr. Donald Trump singled out the reporter during a rally in Florida while criticizing media coverage of his events. He accused her of not covering certain aspects of his campaign efforts. Here's an example using the hashtag. Her supervisor, Andrea Mitchell, sent out this tweet. Katie Turr, NBC, has been doing stellar reporting since day one in hashtag Decision 2016. Let's stop beating up on the media. Hashtag IAmWithHer. That's all for me today, Steve.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The modern smartphone is a light and tiny device that fits in the palm of your hand. And it can link you to the internet, take photos and videos, and oh yeah, make and receive telephone calls and texts. Some people say they couldn't live a day without theirs. But are smartphones making us less trusting of others? Authors of a newly released study gauge the relationship between access to mobile information technology and trust by surveying over 2,000 Americans. The survey included questions such as how often they depend on mobile information technology and how much they trust other groups of people, including family, neighbors, and strangers. The results of the research, published in the journal PLOS ONE, suggest that the more a person depends on smartphones for information, the less likely they are to trust other people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, the 50th anniversary of the Country Music Association Awards, or the CMAs, happened this week. All of that complete with controversy, legendary performances, and some awesome tributes. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks with VOA's Nikki Strong about some of the show's highlights, including Beyoncé.
Oh my goodness, Beyoncé. That was a very symbolic and juicy performance on many levels. I'll try to break it down. She was definitely one of the surprises, especially since it was announced the day of that she was performing, and that sparked a lot of backlash and controversy. Firstly, many in country, you know, critics and fans, etc., interpret Beyoncé's outspoken political views to be unpatriotic and anti-cop, and therefore inconsistent with what country music stands for. So, you know, how dare she be included and pollute the country music tradition and the brand. And then country fans also just, you know, we get tired of pop artists being included in country shows in ways that decenter the genre or the country artist. So, you know, country has its own incredible superstars, and we don't, you know, necessarily need a Beyoncé or anyone else to really celebrate ourselves. But in spite of the controversy, Beyoncé came on. She performed with the Dixie Chicks, not a countrified version of one of her pop songs, but the country song off of her album Lemonade called Daddy's Lessons. Now, Beyoncé, I think it's important to note, doing country is not a gimmick. I remember reading when she was part of Destiny's Child how much they loved country music. She's from Texas. She grew up in it. And in her visual album Lemonade, Daddy's Lessons also visually pays ode to the African-American cowboy tradition and participation and contribution to country Western culture. And that is really rarely celebrated or really acknowledged in any mainstream way. So I find this to be interesting because country music overall draws so much on African-American cultural and musical traditions, but practically never centers African-Americans. So they're usually relegated to the background and support. So when
except
it comes
for, like, I was going to say Charlie Pride. Or
right, exactly. Well, that's my point. I mean, when you think of hugely commercial, successful black country artists, many people just can name Charlie Pride.
Yeah.
They may say Darius Rucker. They might include Ray Charles. And so that says something. So Beyoncé being centered as an African-American, even as a woman too, doing her own country song, celebrating her people's traditions right alongside everyone else, was very powerful. And I think it's strategic that if she was to perform at any country music show, it was the 50th anniversary, a show that is anchored in celebrating the history of the awards and the genre itself. So I thought it was very symbolic and brilliant on her part. In her performance, she brought the traditional hoedown to the Country Music Awards. I mean, she created a party, and people were on their feet, and they embraced it. They gave her a standing ovation. I thought she was engaging and fun and gracious. And I also have to acknowledge Dixie Chicks being a part of her performance. In fact, the performance was a mashup of Daddy's Lessons mixed in with the Dixie Chicks song Long Time Gone, and they've been gone from the CMAs for a while too. I think that was a little, you know, wink. The Dixie Chicks have experienced firsthand what it's like to be ostracized from country music, the industry, and the community for having a different political viewpoint and being outspoken about it. That happened with a criticism of Bush back in 2003, and this was their first time back in a long time. So when the song Daddy's Lessons came out, this is so loaded, country music critics and fans were like, this is not a country song. There was a lot of backlash against Beyoncé for this song. And even Blake Shelton was like, stop it. This is a country song. You know, just get over it. And the Dixie Chicks were the first country group to boldly embrace the song as country by performing it live in their shows on tour. And plus, the Dixie Chicks and Beyoncé, they are all from Texas. So it all made sense and just really turned out wonderful. So I thought the performance was hashtag winning on diversity, on inclusivity, on history, and even education, Daddy's Lesson. So overall, I think the CMAs did a great job of encapsulating so much history in an enjoyable, engaging way within a relatively small amount of time.
Of course, some of the winners.
Okay. Yes, the winners. Okay. So here are some of them. Garth Brooks took home the coveted Entertainer of the Year. Carrie Underwood beat out Miranda Lambert's winning streak for Female Vocalist of the Year. Chris Stapleton won for Male Vocalist. New Artist of the Year was Maren Morris. Album of the Year, Mr. Misunderstood, by Eric Church. Song of the Year, Humble and Kind, sung by Tim McGraw, written by Laurie McKenna. And Music Video of the Year was Fire Away by Chris Stapleton.
You can hear music from all of the CMA winners, legends, and nominees inside Country Hits with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can catch highlights from the CMAs on Facebook and Twitter at VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Came into this world, Daddy's little girl. Daddy made a soldier out of me. Daddy made me dance. Daddy held my hand. Daddy liked his whiskey with his tea. And we rode motorcycles, blackjack, classic vinyl.
Yeah, I think I'm with Blake Shelton. That's a country song for Beyonce, don't you think? Yeah. My wife always has said she should be singing country music. Well, there she was. Actor producer Mila Kunis has said in a new essay that anytime she experiences gender bias now, she's going to speak out. 33-year-old in an essay published on the Medium website said women have conditioned themselves to believe that their livelihoods depends upon them not speaking out against sexist behavior. Kunis, who is married to actor Ashton Kutcher, that is, writes that she is fortunate that she has reached a place in her life that she can do that, stand her ground. We mentioned earlier that Chicago Cubs have broken a 108-year-old drought to win the World Series of Baseball. Well, the Nielsen TV viewer survey company says that the World Series had a whole average over seven games of 23.4 million viewers per game. That last game in Cleveland yesterday for Chicago peaked at just under 50 million viewers at one point between 11:30 and 11:45, because a lot of people on the East Coast, those are East Coast hours, were really big. They were up watching, probably at the bars drinking while I think about it. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Mark Ferguson, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington and wishing you an excellent Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the U.S. State Department is offering up to $3 million for information leading to the location, arrest, and/or conviction of a key ISIL operative, Gulmurad Halimov. Halimov was born in Tajikistan in 1975 and is a former Tajik Special Operations Colonel, police commander, and military sniper. He was once the commander of a police special operations unit in the Ministry of Interior of Tajikistan. He is now a member of ISIL, or Daesh, as it is called in Arabic, and an ISIL recruiter. In May 2015, he announced in a 10-minute propaganda video that he fights for the terrorist group, and he has called publicly for violent acts against the United States, Russia, and Tajikistan. The United States designated Halimov a specially designated global terrorist in September 2015. He was also sanctioned by the United Nations as a terrorist in February 2016. He is wanted by the government of Tajikistan. In June 2015, Interpol issued a red notice for Halimov, alerting member nations that he is a wanted person and should be apprehended for extradition to Tajikistan. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If you have information on Gulmurad Halimov, contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at rewardsforjustice.net. Email at info@rewardsforjustice.net, phone at 1-800-877-3927, or mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
is for,